From Wyoming to Maine, Alabama to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the great deplatforming of 2021 is underway as big tech censors conservative speech. Adam Thier from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to discuss. President Joe Biden is set to push for enactment of his first 100 days agenda. Another COVID-19 relief package is at the top of the list. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. With Democrats taking control of both houses of Congress, is a return to the era of earmarks likely? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Donald Trump fought the swamp, and the swamp won. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on why the swamp is back in control. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Twitter and Facebook banned a sitting president of the United States and have been conducting a purge of conservative speech on their platforms. Here to discuss the implications of their actions is Adam Thier. Adam is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Adam, welcome to American Radio Journal. Adam, is this a concerted effort to squelch free speech?
The social media platforms are trying to deal with a classic media governance problem, which is how do you create a community standard, if you will, for a platform as large as the scope of the internet. After all, Twitter, Facebook, Google, these are not just national services, these are global services. And the question of community standards was a difficult one in the old analog era for broadcast radio and television, but it's nightmarishly difficult in the age of broad-based global social media platforms. And so what they've done by deplatforming not only President Trump, but some of his supporters, is to take some steps to say, like, look, if you push the envelope to the point of inspiring, inciting rebellion and other things like that, well, that would violate our so-called community standards. And of course, there are other things that would violate those community standards. And many people had wanted President Trump or some of his close followers kicked off for other reasons long before. But I think really with the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, that was the moment when these companies felt, well, now's the time to take action before a next administration comes in.
And these companies have a lot of protections. President Trump and others have advocated removing those protections. Should they be removed? Are these platforms really free to police themselves or do what they want as private businesses, or do they have some sort of public responsibility?
The most important protection that these social media companies has is the same protection that every single speaker in the United States has, which is the broad protections of the First Amendment of our Constitution. And that is a sweeping limitation on government's ability to censor or control speech or, for that matter, editorial discretions made by private platforms in any fashion. So I would hope we would not advocate removing or tweaking the First Amendment because I think it served America and our liberties fairly well. Now, there are other things that social media enjoys. Most importantly, Section 230, as it's known, is an obscure provision of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which ensured that these social media platforms would not be held liable for third-party speech or contributions. Basically, if someone says something libelous or crazy online, the intermediary, in this case Twitter, Facebook, Google, Apple, whomever else, they're not going to be held liable for it. That's been a really important policy to make sure that America's overly litigious nature didn't end up discouraging the vibrancy of online speech or the continued existence of some of these platforms. They would be sued out of existence if they could be held liable for what other people said. But what that does leave them with is a difficult question of like how much moderation they should engage in, which was the goal of that law, Section 230, which was to allow for these platforms to engage in a certain amount of moderation of either pornography or hateful commentary or harassing commentary. And now it's turned out to be a big political fiasco because now the very top sitting official in the United States, the president, is someone who's been moderated right off the platform in the case of Twitter and in Facebook. So I think Section 230 is going to be something that Congress addresses. And there are plenty of people both on the right and the left who want to see that law reformed, even though I personally would think it would be a big mistake.
We also have the situation with Parler, Adam, where Parler was essentially kicked off a server by a large provider, and that was actually deplatforming the platform, if you will. What about that situation? Should large companies have the ability to censor entire platforms just because they disagree with them?
We can talk about the question of should they have the right to do it and is it wise to do it. Let's start with the question, is it wise to do it? Generally speaking, I don't think it is. I think it's troubling when you see some large service or platform deplatformed by another platform, especially at the level that Amazon did it with Parler, which is at the so-called infrastructure layer of the internet, if you will. This was a service that Amazon provided through its AWS, Amazon Web Services division, where Parler was hosted there. And once it was kicked off those servers, as well as some other servers, the site, Parler that is, basically went dark. That's not good. The good news, though, however, is that's very, very rare. I mean, let's be clear. Amazon, like most of these other hosting companies, they want to make money. You don't make money by kicking people off your site. Generally speaking, a lot of these companies get in trouble because they don't take a lot of content off their sites. So this is a rarity. On the other hand, it's not good that this happened. And, of course, it happened because there are some voices, some extreme voices on Parler that were agitating for not just the sort of things that happened on January 6th in the Capitol, but for even worse. I mean, there's a lot of racist and white nationalist kind of speech, a lot of hateful and harassing commentary on Parler. And by advocating itself as a sort of a complete unmoderated free speech haven, if you will, it ended up being sort of more like a cesspool of speech. And that's the problem. How do you strike that Goldilocks principle of getting things just right, you know, not too hot, not too cold when it comes to content moderation? We obviously want to see as much speech flow as possible, but we also want to make sure that some of the most awful forms of speech or content are not visible for the most part on these platforms.
The deplatforming effort is also now extended to cable TV. We've had some folks associated with CNN suggesting that Newsmax, One American News, ought to be kicked off the major cable providers. Is that something that's taking it just a step too far?
Well, again, it's generally speaking not good that anybody's deplatformed, whether it's on television or the internet. We would hope, I would think, all of us, that this was a very limited circumstance.
We have been talking with Adam Thierer, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Adam, tell us a bit about Mercatus. You have a couple of books out and where folks can go to read more.
The Mercatus Center at George Mason University is a 501c3 nonprofit research organization. We research law and economics and take a look at the public policy implications of a lot of different things, including things I cover, which are emerging technology and media topics. And if people are interested in learning a little bit more, they can follow me on any social media site, including Twitter. I'm at Adam Thier, and they can read my most recent books on permissionless innovation and more recently one on evasive entrepreneurs.
And you haven't been deplatformed, I assume.
Not yet. They can come to Mercatus.org and find me there, as well as those other social media platforms where I'm at.
Very good, Adam. Adam Thier from the Mercatus Center. Adam, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been, as we all have, watching the inauguration of a new president and a very loaded agenda on Capitol Hill. So we're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me.
As with any new president, Scott, President Biden has a 100-day agenda. Can you give us an overview of what we're likely to see over the first couple of weeks in terms of congressional legislative action?
Yeah, I think that the Biden administration, like every administration, wants to hit the ground running. And what we've seen here is sort of a revert back to the Obama days with a lot of these liberal policies and a focus on climate issues and a focus on immigration and diversity. And of course, they're looking at ways that Democrats can do things through executive action on the coronavirus pandemic. We saw President Biden go ahead and issue a mask mandate executive order directing federal agencies to require mask wearing in federal lands and federal buildings for federal workers. And what we're going to see in the weeks ahead is sort of a focus on a lot of these campaign promises that Joe Biden and his team went ahead and put forward, and they feel like they have a elective mandate. And what we're going to see is whether Republicans join with them to pass any significant legislation and really what that looks like in terms of the coronavirus, and also what the Senate decides to do with the articles of impeachment that have been sent over from the House of Representatives.
In terms of those articles of impeachment, Scott, is that something that could really bring the other business of the Senate to a halt if senators have to deal with that? Or is it, in fact, possible to bifurcate the schedule, as some have suggested?
Well, you can certainly go back and forth between the executive calendar and the legislative calendar in the Senate. But once you're on a specific legislative vehicle, you can't get off of it without unanimous consent or having disposed of it through a vote. But I think that you'll see a focus on the Biden administration trying to get their nominees to the president's cabinet confirmed. We've already seen the confirmation of the ODNI, National Intelligence, and I think that there will be very significant roles in the administration that are going to be accommodated by Republicans in the Senate. And also, of course, we now have a Democrat majority with Chuck Schumer as the majority leader, even though it's a 50-50 Senate. So Schumer and McConnell have been negotiating a power-sharing agreement. The agreement to this point still hasn't been agreed upon, but it's going to likely allow for equal number of members on the committees and the Democrats the ability to manage the floor schedule. But I think there's still outstanding parts of the negotiation related to how they're going to accommodate nominees in committees, because if you can't vote out a nominee with a majority vote, then they, in theory, haven't been reported to the Senate. So it's a little bit different than the Senate rules on legislation. When you're adjudicating nominations, they have to be favorably reported out of the Judiciary Committee or whatever committee of jurisdiction has them.
Looking then at what I suspect will be his top legislative priority, COVID relief, Joe Biden and the Democrats throughout the campaign last year were on the attack on President Trump and his administration in terms of how they have handled the pandemic. Biden has basically said, look, we've got to get COVID under control before anything else can take place. In terms of moving that legislation, do you see that as something that's going to happen quickly, or is the Biden proposal so complex that this is going to get bogged down in the Congress for a couple of weeks, if not months?
A couple of weeks in Washington goes pretty quickly, and I do think that there's a chance that a new coronavirus stimulus package could be moved through the Congress quickly. We know that there are Republicans that want to vote for significant elements, including stimulus checks for the American people, and we know that that's a priority for the Biden administration. So there is an opportunity for a bipartisan agreement to come together. The question is, how far does Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer stretch the rubber band of legislative negotiation? Are they going to pull it back so far that it snaps and completely breaks down the negotiations? Or is Biden going to say, hey, let's focus on vaccines and the delivery and infrastructure related to that. Let's focus on stimulus checks. Let's focus on ways to reopen the economy as much as we can. Or is he going to really just sort of drag his heels and let the Congress find themselves in a gridlock again? Because if they do oversell their own hands and overplay with billions and hundreds of billions of dollars for state and local governments, for example, there's a lot of Republicans that oppose that. And I think that then they get into a situation where the negotiations can certainly become stalled. So I'm going to be watching closely. I know that America is watching closely to see if there's another round of stimulus checks. It seems to be the area that has probably the most consensus among the populace, although there's not a total consensus on Capitol Hill. It does kind of seem like that $1,400 range is in play. And I think Biden also is going to want to come in here and say, look, I got to get some wins right away to show that we're effective and that we're actually adhering to that message from my inaugural speech of bringing about unity in America. So really, a lot of this falls on Biden's shoulders to enact some leadership from the West Wing. And on the coronavirus itself and how sort of the pandemic moves along, look, we're going to have a pretty similar team in place. And so We're going to find out if Anthony Fauci is a genius that was being ignored, or if he's really past his prime and somebody else needs to come in there and take charge. But right now, Anthony Fauci is leading coronavirus efforts with the Biden administration.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, is with the Club for Growth. They're based in Washington, D.C. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more?
The Club for Growth is a organization focused on economic freedom and liberty. And we have a congressional scorecard through our foundation that folks can check out on our website, clubforgrowth.org, and see how their members of Congress or any member of Congress is voting on these pertinent issues before Congress. So I'd encourage everybody to check us out there and also on our Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ending the practice of congressional earmarks for special projects was a reform Republicans brought to Congress many years ago. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says earmarks may return with the Democrats now in control.
Back before the bridge to nowhere was something of a political cliche, there was the Dennis Hastert Highway. Hastert, you may recall, was Speaker of the House back in 2005, and that was when he secured a $207 million earmark to build the so-called Prairie Parkway, a 33-mile highway through the exurbs west of Chicago that was ostensibly meant to connect two interstates. But there was actually another crucial quality to that proposed highway. It happened to run within a few miles of about 300 acres of land that Hastert, his wife, and some business partners had purchased 2 years earlier. That tract of land had no easy access to highways previously, but if Hastert succeeded in getting this highway built, suddenly the land would be much more valuable. Now, that was a quaint scandal by contemporary standards, I'm sure, but the Hastert Highway project was a great example of all the things that could and often did go wrong when Congress used earmarks as political currency. It was wasteful, it was self-serving, and it was opaque. And it was projects like that that eventually led Congress to ban the use of earmarks a few years later. On the other hand, in 2005, Congress did pass a major transportation bill, and that today is something of a quaint notion, too. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a look at the possible return of congressional earmarks. Of course, killing earmarks, one of the major accomplishments of the Tea Party era of Republicans about a decade ago. But now you've got lawmakers actually on both sides of the aisle, but primarily Democrats, who are talking about bringing earmarks back in the new Congress. And that sort of feeds into the message that the new Biden administration is sending too, a message of bipartisanship, of unity, of doing big things again, something that Biden said in his inaugural address, America doesn't do enough of anymore. So earmarks are set for a possible renaissance this year with, as I said, Democratic leaders in the House of Representatives, as well as others, suggesting that a return to pork barrel politics could be a way to break the gridlock in Washington and allow Congress to do more things. And maybe it could even pass a real budget for the first time in years. That would certainly be a good place to start. And it's been long enough now that I think a lot of Americans may not remember just how completely out of control the congressional earmark situation had become by the mid-2000s. That 2005 transportation bill that included Hastert's Highway had over 6,000 items of quote-unquote congressionally directed spending. And at the time, fiscal conservatives actually urged President George W. Bush to veto the bill because they noted that President Ronald Reagan had vetoed a similar bill in 1987 for having only about 150 earmarks. So the growth in earmarks between the late 80s and the mid-2000s was really astronomical, and it included some hilarious examples of government waste, like the $500,000 that was appropriated to refurbish Lawrence Welk's childhood home in Strasburg, North Dakota. Another $500,000 was spent on a planned teapot museum in the tiny hamlet of Sparta, North Carolina. And then, of course, there was the biggest example of wasteful earmark spending of all time, the so-called Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska. a proposed $223 million earmark that would have helped build a bridge in Ketchikan, Alaska, to connect the small town to its airport and replace a ferry service that already operated there. That got thrown into the spotlight of national politics in 2008 when Alaska Governor Sarah Palin framed the project as an outlandish example of Washington waste, even though she had actually previously supported the project, then turned against it, and eventually canceled it. So it was a combination of factors: the Bridge to Nowhere, the Hastert Highway scandal, the 2005 conviction of super lobbyist Jack Abramoff on charges that he'd taken bribes in order to steer funds to a Native American casino project. All of these things sort of combined to make earmarks an obvious target for reform-minded politicians running on promises to clean up Washington a decade ago. But should they be brought back? Critics of the earmark ban argue that it has effectively poisoned bipartisan deal-making in Washington, and that restoring incentives for lawmakers to embrace negotiation and compromise might help to counterbalance some of the partisan forces that fuel rigidity and gridlock. That's how the editorial board of the New York Times put it in December, when the paper argued that lawmakers should abandon the earmark ban. Now, critics of the earmark ban are absolutely right to point out that it really hasn't done anything to curb wasteful spending in D.C. or to reduce spending at all, for that matter. Earmarks, even at their peak in the mid-2000s, accounted for less than 3% of discretionary spending, and discretionary spending is only about one-third of all federal spending, so we're talking about a very small amount of money here. Proponents of undoing the earmark ban are right that shutting off the pork machine hasn't really been as dramatic a shift as some Tea Party-era conservatives might have hoped or promised that it would be. It didn't herald a more accountable Congress, and it certainly hasn't constrained the growth of government. Those are all fair criticisms. But they aren't a convincing case for bringing back earmarks, because the temptation for corruption in the process will always be present, as even some of the pro-earmarkers admit. And promises of reform and transparency are only as good as any political promise. And even when earmarks were happening, it's not like Congress was great at passing appropriations bills or getting budgets done on time anyway. Since the current appropriations system was implemented in 1977, lawmakers have passed all 12 bills required to make up the federal budget just four times, and it hasn't happened at all since 1997. The mid-2000s peak earmark period did not coincide with a dramatically more productive or efficient Congress, and it certainly didn't coincide with a sudden outpouring of bipartisanship. In fact, that was the era when many of the current hardening partisan lines were becoming what they are today. Lawmakers and special interests that want to bring earmarks back are those that see some benefit to them, and certainly earmarks do benefit incumbent congressmen. They can go home to their districts and say, "I've brought you the pork, I've brought this money to build a new museum or a new community park or fix a bridge." But at their core, earmarks are money that the government is spending, that the federal government is spending, to support local projects that can't make it on their own merits. If a teapot museum or the refurbishment of Lawrence Welk's boyhood home was a worthwhile investment, someone in the private sector would have beaten Congress to the punch and put up the money for it already, and made money off it, for that matter. And if a piece of legislation can't get enough support to pass without bribing backbench lawmakers with piles of taxpayer cash, you have to consider the possibility that the bill just doesn't deserve to pass. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the new congressional session and the new Biden administration, everything that's happening in Washington today at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump promised to drain the swamp, but now a new president owes everything to the deep state. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains how this happened on this American Radio Journal commentary.
He fought the swamp, and the swamp won. With apologies to Bobby Fuller for adapting his 60s hit song, "I Fought the Law and the Law Won," that's one way to describe the four turbulent years of Donald Trump's presidency. Trump began leading chants of "Drain the Swamp" toward the end of his 2016 campaign, and huge crowds picked up the chant. It soon became one of the Trump rally's defining themes. In the 3 weeks before the 2016 election, he tweeted "Drain the Swamp" 79 times, usually as a hashtag, and then he tweeted the word "swamp" another 75 times in the 4 years following that election. The arc of that phrase, from rally chant to agenda to its perversion in the final days of his term, is the arc of Donald Trump's presidency. What was the swamp that Trump promised to drain? In the heady final days of the 2016 campaign, the Washington Post wrote, "Trump led cheering supporters in chants of that slogan, promising that he would completely disrupt the culture of Washington. He warned of the power of lobbyists and political donors, who he said effectively bought off elected officials. He told voters he was uniquely prepared to take on the issue because he knew personally, as a contributor, how the system works. When you give, they do whatever you want them to do," he told the Wall Street Journal. Wikipedia has an entry for the phrase "drain the swamp," and it begins, "Drain the swamp is a phrase which has frequently been used by politicians since the 1980s. This phrase alludes to the physical draining of swamps, which is conducted to keep mosquito populations low. It has been used as a metaphor by several politicians preceding Trump, including the sainted Ronald Reagan, but never with the battering repetition of Trump. Yet even though the phrase obviously resonated with the public, it never made its way to the top of the Trump administration's policy agenda." Dan McLaughlin, writing in National Review in November 2016, posed a rational argument that voting for Trump was a version of the old "throw the bums out" political rhetoric, that Democrats and liberal elites have basically reached the point where they feel confident being above the law, eroding long-standing norms of democracy, and getting away with almost anything, and that nothing would shock them out of that complacency, quite like the voters electing a man whose main selling point is that he's not an acceptable member of the club. Then, in this article, this prophetic sentence appears. "Like anyone elected on a throw-the-bums-out ticket, Trump can always be thrown out himself later." I agree with the populist genius of Steve Bannon, whom I believe was orchestrating the Drain the Swamp theme, that the standing Washington establishment, also known as the Deep State, has accumulated more power than the totality of elected and politically appointed officials in our federal government. Furthermore, that behemoth bureaucracy, aided by its allies in the media, will fight without restraint to defend and enlarge its turf, while holding thinly disguised contempt for the political figures who come and go every few years. Yet the standing bureaucracy knows it will always retain and expand its power and ultimately prevail over the best-intentioned swamp drainers. Trump, the outsider, has now been defeated and replaced by a 40-year insider with countless ties to that bureaucracy. While Donald Trump may have fought rhetorically to drain the swamp, his actions in office have often failed to live up to the promise of his words. Eventually, the swamp won. It always does. And now a new president, who owes everything to the bureaucratic and media establishments he has worked with so amiably for over four decades, will gladly do its bidding. In the process, that most treasured of American values, liberty, will be further whittled down. The founders of our great nation and the framers of our great Constitution would be appalled. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXYZ AM in Houston, Texas, KMUD FM in Redway, California, along with KTOK AM in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.